and step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Off Stage and On the Air, performance number 642. My name, as it usually is Lisa Sheps, and I am joined, as usual, by my lovely co-host, Miss Nicole Shiro.
Hello!
You are listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. This show, as many others, stream live at koop.org. Do not go away.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh, yeah.
We're crowded up close and I see this guy. He's squeezing by. I catch his eye. I say to him, where do you think you're trying to go, boy? Whoa, boy! I say, listen, you runt, you're not pulling that stunt. No gentleman pushes their way to the front. I say, move to the back, which he does with a grunt, which is how I saved Roosevelt. Then, while I'm in my seat, I get up.
It is Wednesday, November 10th, 2021. On the show today, we have Cold Frame Collective and their show, Alice in Wonderland. And for the first time on Offstage and On the Air, Kate Meehan, the president of the Biden Payne Committee, will be in to talk about the Biden Payne Awards. And of course, Nicole and I will have a lively discussion in the world of theater in Austin, New York, Chicago, Schenectady, and Terlingua, Texas. Stay with us.
You think that I scare?
You think that I scare? No. I'm going to save the president.
You made me happy you played that. And that's not one we normally play. So
no, we didn't. I tried to go different. We've played from Assassins
like
several
that.
Times. And I wanted to play something different. And that's one that we don't typically play.
I meant
to look up on the Wikipedias. I don't know whether it's true or not. Was there an assassination attempt on President Roosevelt? Is that true?
Probably.
Okay.
I don't know.
I meant to look it up, and I was going to sound all smart and everything, but then I didn't.
Not that I know of, but maybe which one though? Theodore or Franklin?
I would think it would be Franklin. But here's the deal. Most importantly, right now, I would like to thank Kim Simpson for another wonderful International Folk Bazaar. I really enjoyed listening to his show, especially there was one that was in English earlier in the show that was about Copenhagen. And I like Copenhagen.
Copenhagen.
Wonderful,
I like it too.
Wonderful Copenhagen.
It's a place I haven't been to that I'd like to go and visit.
Yeah, I would like to go.
And the music just stirs me there.
There are so many places I haven't been. But
fact check just came in. Yes, there was an assassination attempt on both Roosevelts.
Oh, okay. There you go. Thank you for the fact check. I played the Assassins because the Classic Stage Company's Off-Broadway revival is extended.
Yes, it was going now through the end of January.
Right, it was going to run through January 29th. And I just love Assassins. You know, I might have to
really
do that sometime.
I really like this show. Yeah, I really, really do like this show a lot. And I find the music in it just complex and delightful. But I mean, it is Sondheim, but right. Well, it's just different for him,
yeah.
For me.
And this one stars the likes of, and I don't know that we've talked about it on the show before, but Brandon Uranowitz, Stephen Pasquale, mm-hmm. Will Swenson, Wesley Taylor, Judy Kuhn. Yeah, amongst other people. So that's pretty cool.
And I think it's spectacular.
Yeah, so that's why we played a little of Assassins. And we had an off-Broadway opening at the Public Theater in a show called The Visitor, which was originally scheduled to open in March of 2020. And then, of course, that did not happen. So in that case, it just opened on November 4th. Did not get great notices. And mostly because it was really, it was, well, so this is based on a movie from 2008, and it's got kind of a white savior complex. So it's about a white man, in this case, played by David Hyde Pierce. And he is coming to New York for a convention or something, I think. And in his house that it's been sitting empty, two squatters who were undocumented immigrants from, I believe, the Mideast were living there. He becomes friends with them.
I believe that is all correct.
So
from what I recall.
It got a lot of heat because it's very dated. White savior complex is something we don't like to highlight anymore on stage. And they didn't really update it very much. So I should say, this is a musical. It's directed by Daniel Sullivan. It has a book by, and I'm going to kill this name, Kwame Kwi Arma, as well as Brian Yorkey. And Tom Kitt wrote the music. And if you recognize those two names, Yorkey and Kitt, you know that they wrote Next to Normal.
Yeah.
So one of the things that the critic in the Times, it was written by Maya Phillips, said was, oh my God, I'm having trouble with my computer screen. It's not allowing me to get into where I want to go. She said, to stage the project now without a more significant overhaul of the story was a bold choice, especially with the masking and quarantining coinciding with a reckoning about how people of color and their stories more often are not represented in theater arts. So she said it was a bold choice and not necessarily a good one.
Interesting.
Yeah, but they did try to make some modifications. They actually mention in the words white savior. But they had a lot of problems. One of the leads left. They said it was a mutual decision, but I don't know what that really means.
Mutually about what?
Yeah. And it, again, it focuses on the white protagonist, which is something many shows are trying to get away from. One of the podcasts I listened to was talking about this and talking about the ill-fated nature of this and why they decided to do it without updating it, and talking about how film, you know, that is done and is given a little bit more of a pass than theater because it was filmed in that time where it was filmed.
Yeah.
And many people expect theater to either update or not do when they can't do it.
I guess, like, you know, film is almost a time capsule that has been captured.
Yeah.
Like,
And I kind of agree with that, Nicole, because I do think, I know people that say there's no place in theater anymore for the older shows. And I don't necessarily agree with that.
Me neither. You and I have both. I think you and I kind of feel the same way on this when we talked about it before.
Yeah. So it took a lot of hits, especially in the lyrics. It said, she said, Yorkey's clunky lyrics are ultimately what does the show in. But she loved the ensemble. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read this. She says, quote, "The ensemble, however, often upstages the main cast, etching small, remarkable performance moments, even in the background and during fleeting transition numbers." I just kind of like that she recognized that.
I do. I was just about to say, I like that.
Yeah. I was just talking to somebody about ensemble work in general and how wonderful. And when I go to see a big musical that has a large ensemble, I just love looking at the ensemble and those times where some of those actors or many of the actors are completely engaged and, you know, they have a character and a backstory and everything just makes me so happy.
Yes. Yes, it does.
So that's The Visitor, or as I typed it in my file, The Visitro. They should consider changing their name. So we may
have The Visitro.
The Visitro. We may have talked about this, but Billy Crystal is coming to Broadway in a musical about Mr. Saturday Night, which was
they announced a whole bunch of the stuff on that.
They did. So it's going to open in March of 2022. Previews March 1st to March 31st opening at the Nederlander Theater. The score is by none other than Jason Robert Brown.
Yes, I found that kind of interesting. I didn't expect that.
Yeah. Billy Crystal is playing Buddy Young as the title role, which is the same role I believe he played in the movie from 1992.
I think so.
And another in the cast is Randy Graff, David Paymer, and Chasten Harmon. It already had a run at the Barrington stage in October, 9 performances. So we'll see. I'm kind of excited for this.
Very exciting.
It's directed by John Rando, which that last name is kind of Rando.
It's kind of Rando, and maybe that's why you made it Visitro.
That's true. But folks will remember John Rando because he directed Urinetown.
Yeah. I mean, hasn't he done something since Urinetown, though?
I don't know. I'm going to say probably. Urinetown was a long time ago.
But I could be wrong. I know. That's why I was like, wait a minute. But I feel like he's done something more.
So I want to find out how you feel about the current casting announcement for Wicked the movie.
Love it.
I do as
amazing.
Well.
I actually, my brother and I were sitting at dinner Saturday night, and I'm like, can I talk about this with you? Like, I just think it's phenomenal. He wasn't as excited about me, but you know, as I was, but I felt it was that exciting. I brought it up.
So the people that that Nicole is referring to is Cynthia Erivo, who will play Elphaba, and Ariana Grande will play Glenda.
Yeah, I actually said I think both of these two could give the originals a run for their money in how they perform some of these numbers.
I think you might be right. I mean, I really applaud this
so
casting.
Exciting.
Although I have not seen Ariana Grande's acting chops. Have you?
Yes, she was in, but yeah, and she started on Broadway. Remember, she was in Jason Robert Brown's original 13.
Oh, that's right. You're right. Okay, good. Now that makes me even more happy.
She started on the stage.
Yep. So, so that makes me excited about this film. And this film has been fraught. It's had so many stops and starts.
It's had a lot of, you know, that's why I was like, boy, I feel like we've hit a lot of potholes, and I feel like they finally have paved the road and we have some smooth sailing ahead.
Yep. I'm with you.
Along this wicked highway. That's exciting.
Yep. Looking forward to that. Okay, we're going to, I've got to like step this up because we're going to run out of time, but I also want to just, I don't know whether you saw the West Side Story trailer. They just released a new one.
I did, and it's, it came up because I was actually watching the Cyrano trailer with your Peter Dinklage.
Yes, which is good, looks good.
Oh, yes, it does. I got very excited to tell you that, and then the West Side Story came up as a suggestion, and I watched that one afterwards.
Well, so there will be a link at offstageonair.com to the trailer. This is the third trailer. The first one was kind of meh. The second one was amazing.
And the third one is... The second one's still my favorite.
Yep, the third one is good. It just
good.
Makes me want to see... It makes me want to see the show. And evidently, I did not know this. I'm going to guess you did. There is a Netflix documentary... on Cheetah.
Oh, I did know about that.
I haven't seen it yet.
It premiered at Tribeca Film Festival and some of the other film festival and Outfest in a few places. But yes, I'd like to get my hands on that. If I get a screener link or access or something, I'll let you know.
You could come over to my house and see it on Netflix.
Well, we could. We could have a Cheetah popcorn party and watch that. I'd
could.
Be excited.
I would like that. And this is
Let's
not in the script.
Happen,
and I don't know how it got left off in the script, but I want to talk about this now while we still have time. In American Theater Magazine, there's an article called A Manifesto for the Future Stage. Performance is a Human Right. And it's written by a consortium of people called the Data...
Folks. Few folks.
A few, lots actually.
Yeah.
And it's collectively written by the Future Stage Research Group. But basically what they're saying, and let me just read, I'll read the very first paragraph. This says, quote, performance isn't a commodity. It isn't a luxury. It isn't something that gets added on top of the flow of life. It doesn't belong to ether, to the state, or to private funders. It doesn't belong to the places where it's performed. Whether it assumes the form of a street-side improvisation or a formal staging of a consecrated work from centuries past, it belongs to the moment. And they go on talking about how performance, and I'll just, because I care more about theater, but of which theater is part, of how it's a human right and it should not be, what's the word I'm trying to come up with? It shouldn't be withheld. It should be made available. It should be funded.
I agree.
Did you happen to read this article?
I saw it and I started reading it and then I got sucked into work so I did not finish.
It's kind of long. But one of the things it says, and I know this is something that's important to you because we talk about it a lot, it says that no child's education should be considered complete if they haven't experienced the performing arts that are integral to their culture. Very, very important.
Yeah. Here.
It spends a lot of time talking about what we've learned during the pandemic and that we really need to, streaming and other electronic digital forms of theater and performance should not go away and should be given their own, just their own seating and their own section. For instance, they put a big difference between streaming a live performance by just streaming that live performance and something that is specifically tailored to the digital audience.
I agree.
Yep. So that's good. I'm just going to go. I found this funny. It's a long article, but they had some different roles, people roles. And I just want to go through some of them because they're kind of fun. So there's the waiting room hipster, the WRH, who is the person that meets you in the Zoom space before we go, the virtual space realtor, the lagmaster general, the live captioning maestro, the screenographer, the accessibility ombudsman, and that's actually a pretty big one. The whole accessibility thing with digital is really opened up performance spaces to many people that haven't been able to see it. The performance doula and the meta bundler.
Who came up with all these names? Someone had to sit there for a while.
But anyway,
people.
There will be a link to this at offstageonair.com, and there it's a long article, and I would encourage folks to look at it. It also talks about funding and how the current funding is outdated, and we need to try to fix it.
Oh, yes. We're here on that.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yep.
On a myriad of reasons.
Of levels, they say.
Yes, yes.
So I thought it was interesting. Actually, I got an email. I had already had this in here, but you sent an email, or Motley Crue Media sent an email about the Cindy Williams show.
That's coming not only to Houston, but
it's also coming here to Austin. And it's called Me, Myself,
and San Antonio for Texas.
And in San Antonio. It's called Me, Myself, and Shirley. And of course, Cindy Williams played Shirley in Laverne and Shirley. And it chronicles the stories, her secrets, her embarrassing moments, and highs and lows of her life in Hollywood. Looks like a lot of fun.
It is. There's going on a whole little national tour starting in January.
Yep. And there's a link. I forgot when it's here because I didn't. Oh, wait, maybe I did write it down. I didn't. But there is a link to the website, which
it's
has
the Austin February 10th through 13th.
February 10th through 13th. There you go. So that is a good thing. Another thing, just while we're talking about stuff, two things. Dana H. and This Is a Room extended by another week or two, I think.
Yes, I saw that.
That was good. That they were the first to announce a closing at post-pandemic. And they also got just total 100% raves. So that's
yeah, they really did.
Interesting thing. And then Greg Kinnear was announced to be in To Kill a Mockingbird to play Finch 2.
Actually, I think that's an interesting choice. And I mean, for a good reason. Like, I like Greg Kinnear.
I do as well. I think he's a fine actor. I've never seen him live.
Yes.
But he's set to replace Jeff Daniels. And in theory, he'll finish the show out because it's set to close.
Yeah, and he's different. And I just think it'll be a different look. I was like, what a great casting choice.
I agree. Look at us agreeing.
A casting director might know something.
That's true. All right, my final little thing I want to talk about right now is another article around sound designers, and specifically sound designers of color. I think it is a New York Times article. Broadway News. And they talk about the lack of sound designers that aren't, you know, white guys. And this season, the sound designer, Twee McCollum, who's a woman, she made her Broadway debut in Chicken and Biscuits, and she's the first woman of color to design sound on Broadway.
Woohoo!
And the sound designer on This Is a Room is also a person of color. And some other milestones. In 2011, Cricket S. Myers was the first woman to ever be nominated for a Tony for sound design. And in 2019...
I love the name Cricket, by the way. I get so excited when I meet or hear someone with the name Cricket. I just love it.
One of my neighbors, when she became a grandmother, wanted Cricket to be her grandma name, but that didn't hold for their family.
I'm sorry for her because I would have been on her side.
Yeah. So anyway, that's also a really great article in talking about the pipeline of sound designers is going to try to open up. And there's been a slew since the pandemic of training sessions for more technical theater.
I've seen a lot of the training and I guess symposiums kind of for people to.
There have been. There have been.
Meet and do and learn and.
Yep.
Very exciting.
All right. Well, we're going to take a little break right now, and we're going to listen to a song from The Visitor called Lady Liberty. We will be right back. Don't go away.
Century standing that long, holding the hopes of a nation.
You're listening to Off Stage and On the Air with Lisa, and not Nicole right now, because she has hung up the phone. So I want to take a moment to introduce our first guests here. They're not here in the studio because we are pre-recording. But I sat down with Audrey Barrett and Caroline Bobbitt of Cold Frame Collective, and they talked about their show that's just about to open called Alice in Wonderland. So here is that interview. Here I am alone in the Zoom room, just me. But I'm not really alone because I am joined by a couple of folks from Cold Frame Collective, say that three times, and their show coming up, Alice in Wonderland. I have the director of the show, Audrey Barrett. Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
And the producer, Caroline Bobbitt. Hi, Caroline.
Hello.
And you guys are both also the founders and the artistic directors of Cold Frame Collective, correct?
We are, yes.
There you go. See, I got everything right. And Caroline, you're also in the show.
I am.
Okay. So there's many hats being worn here.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Quite literally. Okay.
So I think most people know the story of Alice in Wonderland, but this is your own version of it. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
It's a bit of a Frankenstein of some Lewis Carroll directly, another super old script by Alice Gestenberg. That was the first dramatization of Alice, and then some of Us. So it's a little bit of a Frankenstein altogether, kind of telling the version of the story that we wanted to keep it a little bit fresh and a little bit unexpected.
Yeah, cool. Well, can you give us... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it was just also some of our most beloved pieces that are generally left out of a script or kind of like washed over and only touched on as we got to go into kind of the meat that Lewis Carroll goes into, which was really fun.
So tell us some of the meat that you're going into that might pique our interest.
Well, so I love the queens of Alice in Wonderland, and there is the Forgotten Queen, the Red Queen, who is very often sort of used to amalgamate into the Queen of Hearts, when in fact she is her own character.
Interesting.
So, yeah, there's a Red Queen, White Queen, Queen of Hearts, and they are all separate. So we've gotten to give the Queen of Hearts, or the Red Queen, the respect that she deserves and give her her own character. And she gets to play a foil to Caroline's White Queen, which has also been a really fun thing to see the two of them play off of each other.
Well, excellent. No, so the this adaptation is written by you, or are you using the words from the show? I mean, where are you getting your dialogue from? I must know. It's important.
Sure. I'm the scientist behind the script, not necessarily the writer. A lot of it is directly from Lewis Carroll. A lot of it is from that original adaptation that, again, it's so old, but it's public domain. And then some of it is us. But in terms of dialogue, it's all faithful to Lewis Carroll or to that adaptation. Sometimes she takes some of the like stream of consciousness that Alice is having in her brain and turns it into dialogue and things like that. And also what we've done is played along with the kind of chronological order of what happens, because everyone has seen Alice so many times and knows the story so well. We've kind of messed with the order of things a little bit, so you still might find yourself being surprised and not knowing what's going to happen next, because we're going to keep you on your toes even though you know the story.
Well, excellent. So when I think of Alice in Wonderland, I think of a children's story. But of course, we've had some more adult versions. Is this an Alice in Wonderland for kiddos, or is it for adults, or a mix of the two?
Well, we didn't intend for it to be this big family show, and yet it has turned into us being able to invite family members with kids. It's been totally like, oh, this is totally fine for anyone to come and see. So
yeah, so it's definitely aimed at all ages. There will definitely be some things that will go over the kiddos' heads, but everything's totally appropriate for them. So yeah, we think it's for anyone that wants to.
Is music involved in your production?
Very much so. What a great question. So we have been working with a fabulous composer, Bryce Rafferty, who has been doing original scoring for the play. And it's part of what we're most excited about is to bring some original music into this production.
We know Bryce. He has performed at Ground Floor Theater many, many times.
We know him too.
Well, see? Okay. Well, thanks for coming on the show. Well, that's wonderful. So he's composing music for it. Is there any, you know, is there any part of your creative team or your production team that you want to highlight here right now, other than the music?
Well, I think our lighting designer, Patrick Anthony, has been a huge part of just believing in us and heightening everything that we're planning and able to do out in an outdoor space, for sure. Definitely bringing some magic there.
Ah, okay. So that's actually a very good question. So this is outdoors at Center Stage. You're not indoors at Center
Correct.
Stage.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. We're using the backyard as our space. And yeah, we just felt like it's what we're still most comfortable with is an outdoor theatrical experience. So we're really lucky to have this space available to us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. I've actually never been to their outdoor space, but that's good. And it's on Real Street. Mm-hmm. Some people like to call it Real Street, but I don't.
Real.
I'm not one of them. Well, that's excellent. So it's outdoor, and you have a relatively large cast. Looks like you have 10 or 15 people.
12 actors, yeah, including Caroline. Hello.
Hello, I'm acting in this show. Well, that is awesome. When does the show open?
We open on Friday. We open Friday, November 12th.
Okay. And how long do you play? Tell folks when they can go and where they can go to get information.
Sure. We run two weekends, Friday, Saturday, first weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, second weekend. So close on the 20th.
We are on Brown Paper Tickets at coldframecollective.brownpapertickets.com. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. Everything is just Cold Frame Collective.
Awesome. Well, and actually, I don't know if you planned it this way, and you have the inimitable Patrick Anthony doing your lighting. And at 7 p.m., it will be damn dark now that we're back on standard time. So did y'all plan for that? Because as you know, when you do an outdoor show and lighting, you have to figure out what your start time is going to be so you can light it.
Sure. Yes, we absolutely planned that and did not forget about the time change. Knew it was coming. We're ready for it. It'll be very dark, just as we intended.
Excellent. Well, that is great. And I also just do want to, in some of the stuff I read, you are have an alliance with and a sponsorship with the Stage Austin, which actually was, I think they've closed their show Love Letters, or it's got another weekend this weekend.
It's got one more weekend, yeah.
So that's great. Tell us about your relationship with the Stage.
Sure. So Jeff Hinkle is just one of my favorite people in Austin and has oh so kindly taken us under his wing and given us support in any way that he is able to, including having the Stage Austin sponsor our last couple of productions while we're still, you know, we're very new, we're very little. And it's been a really, it's been a great support to have the Stage Austin. And their goals line up with ours really well about creating, you know, ethical theater and everything. So it's been really helpful to have them around.
Excellent. So now you are, I believe, 3 years old. Y'all came about in 2018, if I'm correct. And this is your third. This is your third production, or were there more that I'm not seeing?
This is our fifth production. Yeah.
Fifth. Okay. Well, there you go. That's my notes. I'm going to fire my researcher.
Is your researcher you?
Excuse me. I think there's something wrong with the connection. I do have to say that, you know, Alice in Wonderland is very dear to my heart because the very first show that I was ever in my entire life in 1967 at the Alley Theater, their school, it was called the Yellow Brick Road, but it was an amalgam of all of these. And I played the Seven of Hearts in the Alice in Wonderland scene.
Nice. Yep.
I do. I still remember my line. So there you go. So that is great. So I am so happy that you guys joined me on the show again. Oh, one last thing that's very important. I know we are getting close to being in stage two, COVID-19. You guys are outside, which is a good thing. Is there anything else that people should expect with regard to COVID mitigation?
We always, of course, strongly recommend wearing masks, just depending on your comfort level. Know that we are a completely vaccinated a company of actors. I will say, if you are not comfortable with audience interaction, don't sit in the front seats.
Okay, there you go. Stay out of the splash zone.
Splash zone, exactly. 100%.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the show, and I look forward to seeing it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Off with our heads. It's my one real million.
So let's talk about what's going on locally. I want to remind folks that atxtheater.org is your place to go for everything Austin Theater.
It has a smorgasbord of what's happening, what's going on, what will be happening, who's doing what,
yep,
where to find resources, and all that jazz.
All that jazz. And it's starting to fill up with shows, which is great. So it actually links directly.
And the little newsletter was hearty today.
It was hearty. So I believe that this is the last weekend for Love Letters, who came here on this show. And that's something to see. And also The Tasters, also on this show, plays the 14th. That one I really wanted to see because it was all about food tasters.
We like the food.
The Vortex, we weren't on the show. On the 13th of this month is Obituary. And it says, done through conjuring practice, Eva Margarita will make activated charcoal as a means of creating an ink
that acknowledges the personal and social stains. I don't know.
I found that interesting. And the images they have are really cool looking.
Yep. And I should say also that 12 theaters, Ground Floor Theater is one of them, is part of Playfest, Austin Playfest, first annual, really sort of organized by the folks over at Austin Playhouse. And it is a virtual play festival with 12 theater companies showing their mostly digital work or a video of past performances. And you can see one or all, and there are panels, and it looks like a lot of fun.
A whole bunch of different stuff, and there's information on all the different companies and what's happening at AustinPlayFest.com. Pretty cool.
It is very, very, very cool. Ground Floor Theater, because I'm most familiar with that, is our entry into that is Trans Lives, Trans Voices, which won the B. Iden Payne Award.
I was about to say, talk about that B. Iden Payne, please.
Yeah, and we're gonna get there. But before we do, we're gonna do Today in Theater History. Today in theater history. It's jam-packed. Everybody had birthdays today.
Oh, today was a good birthday, huh?
It was. But you'll remember back in 1900, turn of the century.
That was a cold year.
It was the opening night. Tonight was the opening night of the legendary musical Floradora at the Casino Theater. For a 553 performance run. So whenever I think of Floradora, I think of the Floradora girls from Little Spanky and Our Gang, the Little Rascals.
Oh, yes. Now, you know what? I will now forever think of that from you just saying that.
Me too. And in 1925, the year of my father's birth, is the birthday of one Richard Burton.
Oh, really?
Yep. And the musical he was in, one might remember, is Camelot. And he was known quite well for so many things, but he was also with Elizabeth Taylor, many things with Elizabeth Taylor, and married to her twice, I believe. But he was in the movie of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
He was.
And there is a revival of that that's about to happen that has an interesting cast, and I cannot remember who it is. Oh, it's what's his name that was in Assassins. Anyway, can't remember.
You mean
Mario Cantone?
Yes.
He's in it, woman is.
Oh gosh.
Can't remember. But anyway, that's happening. So.
No, but it'll come to my head now.
Okay. Let's let it go for now.
Keep going.
1944 is the birthday of your friend Tim Rice. Who was the better part of the Tim Rice and Lloyd Webber thing. He wrote the lyrics for Evita, Jesus Christ Superstar, Aida, and Chess. And it is also
Calista Flockhart.
Thank you, Calista Flockhart. It was also the birthday of Anne Rankin. We've talked about
her
a lot on this show, who just passed away not all that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
In 1950, Uta Hagen and Paul Kelly star in Clifford Odets, The Country Girl at the Lyceum. Uta Hagen
I
won.
I love Uta Hagen.
Well, she won the Tony Award for that.
Well, she's so there. Quite talented. I'm not surprised.
Yep. I'm going to skip a few. 1970, Danny Kaye as Noah in 2x2, the Richard Rodgers and Martin Charnin musical. I love me some Danny Kaye. And he did it. He had a broken leg, and he played the part in a wheelchair.
Are you really surprised? Because I'm not. Danny Kaye seems like he'd wheel his hospital bed in to keep doing things.
I'm not at all. And this is something that I should have known without having to look it up. 40 years ago, Lisa Sheps opened on Broadway in Oh Brother on this date.
That was today?
Yep.
Oh, my gosh, Lisa. I love that we finally got...
We made it onto the Today in
Theater History.
So I'm just going to read the playbill blurb because it says a lot. So, Oh Brother, Michael Valenti's... Oh, interesting. It just mentioned Michael Valenti and not the person that wrote the... Donald Driver, who wrote the book in the lyrics. Oh Brother, Michael Valenti's musical based on the comedy of the era, relocates Shakespeare's story of mistaken identity to revolutionary Iran. The taking of American hostages during its prep period does little to help its appeal, and it closes after just three performances, despite the presence of Judy Kay, David James Carroll, Harry Groener, and Richard Jewell. The cast album inspires a modest cult of fans.
Well, yeah. There you go.
It was an amazing show. I have to tell you that.
Do you have album credit? Are you?
No, I was not on. I did not. I did not. I was not there for the cast album recording.
Well, I'm going to write you in.
There you go. So we're going to take another little break, and then we're going to come back with our last interview, and we are going to hear we're going to hear a song called Opec Maiden, sung by Harry Groener at Oh Brother. And I will say farewell to you, Nicole Shiro.
I will say F1 until next week.
Okay, here's Oh Brother.
Bangle laden, Opec Maiden.
Okay, I cannot believe that we have been on the air for 13 years, and I don't think we've ever had this person on our show about in this role that we are going to speak to her with. I'm going to give away the surprise. We have Kate Meehan here, who is the president, among other things. She's many, many hats, but she is, in this case, the president of the B. Iden Payne Awards Council. Welcome back to the show, Kate.
Glad to be here. Good to see you.
Well, I wanted to talk to you because the B. Iden Payne Awards ceremony was last night at the top of the Contemporary, and it was such a beautiful ceremony. And, you know, you haven't been able to do one for the past couple of years. And I wanted to talk about the B. Iden Paynes, what it was like to deal with this award ceremony in this new environment, the pandemic, and what the future is. So let's talk specifically first about, this year is different from all other years, in that most theaters were not producing live theater. So B. Iden Payne did a pretty good job of pivoting to a lot of digital categories, if you will. So tell us about that process and how that all transpired.
Well, we did have a ceremony last year. It was just all online and was very sad for me anyway, because
I was there.
Yeah, I mean, we all love when we get together, and I mean, aside from the like community celebrating each other's work together, there's a lot of really great scheming that goes on about next work that I think is really valuable for me as an artist. And just to see, we like to also play Yenta if there are folks that whose work that we've seen that we may not have, that may not have met each other. We like to make introductions and see what happens. So our philosophy has always been that if we see something outstanding that is new, where we start to see trends, we call it making a bucket, where it's like, even though we don't actually have a category for it right now, if it's great, you know, we'll make room to award things that deserve awards. And so we add new categories all the time. We added production dramaturgy a couple of years ago. We've added puppetry. Every year we tend to add one or two categories just based on outstanding work that people are doing. And often once people see that the category exists, they start to honor the people who are doing that work in the community a little bit more. So it was a really easy switch to just start including digital performances. And what we saw this year is that the digital categories became a lot richer. We started to get audio plays, which was really fun, and let the theatrical experience go in different places. It was cool to see just how nimble artists are, and the way art will always find a way, no matter how isolated we get, we'll figure out ways to touch each other and make cool things. So.
Right. So as we close out the last season, and I should say that we are joined by Nicole Shiro. Hello, Nicole. Welcome to the Zoom room.
Hello.
So as we have closed out this season, and in theory opening up this new season, We are entering into what we hope is the post-pandemic world where theater will come back. And people on this program are tired of hearing me say how important it is to sit shoulder to shoulder with somebody in the audience, sharing the energy with the actors on stage. And we hope to see that back again. Do you see the B. Iden Payne's keeping many of the categories that you created in this very different year?
Weird season. That's a great question. So it just depends on what the community does. We tend to look at which awards will wind up existing based on what we see. So if at the end of the year there aren't at least three nominations that have wound up on a shortlist, you know, it just feels kind of weird to have a category with two people. And then so we look at it and go, well, maybe these two people just need to have a special certificate or something along those lines. But having a category where people pick between two folks just seems awkward. So it really just depends on what happens next year. I mean, I hope we're able to keep some of the digital categories and that that kind of work is still produced. But it was really interesting putting the categories together and lumping all live theater into one category. Where usually those are, you know, split up a little bit. And but yeah, I mean, there were seven live productions that we saw last year.
Sure.
And ordinarily we'd see 175. So it is what it is.
Actually, that's a perfect segue. So let's just pretend that other than the new categories that we go through, that next year you see 175. One of the things that I think people might find interesting is what it takes to adjudicate 175 shows,
right?
With just a handful of people going to see those shows. And I know there are very specific rules. So how does that work?
I am so glad you asked. I am always delighted to talk about how we make our sausage and nobody ever wants to hear it. So thanks for providing me with a platform for that.
I like sausage.
I like sausage too. So most years we have about 30 people that sit on the council. And when we recruit, we try really hard to get as many different types of knowledge backgrounds on the council. Because none of us are you know, skilled in every possible thing. We try to make sure that we've got costumers and tech people and sound experts and performers of all kinds. First of all, we meet every month. We meet the last Monday of every month and with, you know, some little shuffling around for holidays. And at each of those meetings, we talk about all of the shows that have closed since the last time we met. We have a database where when y'all submit your shows, that information goes into that database and we send a minimum of five people to see the show. Now, if we only send five people, I start sending nasty grams out to the group and say, hey, we need to hop on this, because the more of us that see it, the more of us can advocate for the work that we see. At each meeting, you know, we'll go through and we'll talk about all of the things that were outstanding about the show and things that we found remarkable about it. And then make nominations of work that we thought was really great. And, you know, if more than half of us who saw the show agree that it was really great, it goes on the short list. And that is an ever-growing list throughout the year that we revisit, usually the Sunday after Labor Day weekend, after the season closes. We have a very, very long meeting where we've started a new process where we kind of have the shortlist and we vote to kind of narrow the shortlist down before we get there. So we kind of know which battles we're going to pick before we show up to the meeting. And if it looks like one of the shows that, or nominations that you're really passionate about isn't going to make it on the ballot, we fight for it. And so that meeting is really about all of us advocating for work that we saw and things that want to go on the ballot. And sometimes we walk away a little heartbroken about things that didn't make it on. But usually by the end of that meeting, we look at our ballot and are pretty proud of what we put together. In awesome. Part because it's a year's worth of work. I mean, most of us, the biggest thing that I think, if you look at our membership, and we post it every year, it's on our website, you can see our faces, and you know most of us, I'm sure. But often folks will be on for about a year and then they'll just sort of not renew because it is a lot of work. I mean, we have to see, in order to stay on the council, you need to see an average of one show a week, which doesn't seem like a lot until you realize that that just means every weekend, you know, if you're in a show, you're seeing children's theater in the afternoon before heading to rehearsal while trying to learn your lines in the car in between everything. If you go on vacation, you're seeing two shows in a weekend. It really changes the way you think of your leisure time in a really fantastic way, because it means that when you're thinking about what you're going to do in a weekend, it includes participating in your community. But that's just not possible for everyone, or something that they're into. So often they'll stick around for a year, learn a lot, and then go, cool, okay, I want my weekends back.
Of course. Well, it's terribly complicated. And we're looking forward to next year. Again, the award ceremony is a lot of fun, and folks don't have to be in the community to go to that award ceremony.
Nope.
So we'll look forward, for those of you that missed it this year, you'll go next year. And we're like totally out of time, but I did want to just take a brief moment for you to change hats to your artistic director of La Fenice and talk about the show that you've got running right now. So just give people the nickel tour, where it is, what it is, and how they can find information.
Yeah. So we're partnered with an improv group in town called Golden. They do silent improvised theater. And a couple years ago, we produced a show, Golden did, I'm also a member of Golden, produced a show that was based on Sleep No More in Manhattan. And this one is called Speak No More. This version of it is called Golden Age. It's set 100 years ago, and we're performing at the Neil Cochran House. So it's basically improvised, site-specific. You get to be a voyeur and pick your path and find what stories you want to hear. And or not hear, because it's silent. See, witness. So we're running this Friday and next Friday and Saturday. I think Friday's already sold out. I think there's probably about 10 tickets left for each night.
Awesome.
On Friday and Saturday of next week. And you can get tickets at LaFeniceAustin.org.
Awesome. And before we go, please tell people how they can get information about the Biden Pains. And if they're interested in being on the council, where they would get information about that.
Yeah, absolutely. BidenPainAwards.org.
That's true. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. I was second guessing myself. Yeah. There's all kinds of information on that website, who we are, past winners. We recruit in June of every year. If you are on our email list, which you can join at the bottom of that website, you will, first of all, get a ballot, most importantly, for next year. But also we are sure to include invitations to all of our social events that we have usually in the spring, and then definitely let you know when we are recruiting in June.
Awesome. Well, Kate Meehan, thank you for being on Offstage and on the air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody doesn't get a trophy. Everybody doesn't win the prize. No sprinkles for you, no cherry on top. If you don't come in first, then you're a flop.
Everybody does not get a trophy, except everybody does get a trophy. So that was Kate Meehan, the Biden Pain Awards. They happen once a year, and the awards are just given out this last week. I'm proud to say that Ground Floor Theater received recognition for Trans Lives, Trans Voices, as well as our set designer, Gary Thornsberry, for Rainfall's special on me. So there you go. You spent an hour with Lisa and Nicole, and we are going to be finishing up. Remember, you can get all the information that we talked about at offstageonair.com.
and you can get links to what we talked about and all that stuff. So we're going to leave you in here in a little while. DJ Mark is next with Live Texas Music Mixtape. We'll see you next week when we look at what's happening offstage and on the air. Bye, everybody.
You get it.